Then we have the norm that there should be sex within marriage, that that's the proper place for sexual intercourse to occur. It shouldn't happen outside of marriage. Well, to undermine this norm required access to contraception and abortion. And so we have in 1969, a year after the Divorce Act, that Canada legalizes contraception, and that Canada also makes it much easier to get for women to get abortions. So in effect then, we are ensuring that people can have sex outside of marriage and not have any consequences as a result of that. And with that, because procreation is not necessarily at issue, also sex, procreation, marriage become severable. Okay, let's fast forward now to our time in history. And another norm that is being challenged of marriage, and this is the norm that marriage is between a man and a woman. Now recall from the experience that went before that generally these norms fit together. They rely upon each other. If you dismantle one, you're weakening others. And that is true of the norm that marriage is between a man and a woman. Because if marriage is not between a man and a woman, if it can be between any combination of consenting adults, but it is still the foundation of family life, that means that we no longer need mothers and fathers. Indeed, in law, as a result of Bill C-38, both explicitly and implicitly, parents, biological parents, mothers and fathers, have been replaced with legal parents. What does that mean? The implications of a legal parent is to make it normal. One of the primary functions of law is that it is educative, and that is especially so in a society such as Canada, which holds the rule of law in very high esteem and its charter in very high esteem. So the idea that now we have legal parents means that we don't have an expectation that children have mothers and fathers. Now, if we don't have an expectation that they have mothers and fathers, and we want to ensure that procreation can be severed from sex and marriage, the result of this is that when we have children now, we have children because we're choosing to have children. That to have a child is a choice. It's my choice. I should be able to decide whether I'm going to have a child. Now, what does this mean in terms of the same-sex marriage debate? Think about how couples of the same sex acquire children. The only way that they can acquire children is for the bond between mother, father, and child to be severed. That's the only way they can become parents. Now, the most typical ways in which this can happen, usually it happens through divorce, that you have a formerly heterosexual couple where mom or dad decides, no, I'm really not like that anymore, leaves, takes a child with them to a new relationship. So yes, you've already had a tragedy there in terms of that child's life. Other ways that this can happen is through reproductive technologies. You can sever the mother-child bond, the father-child bond, by turning the process of reproduction into nothing more than a scientific procedure in which we have sperm donors and egg donors and rented wombs. And so we won't be able to trace back who the real mother and father is. We have to sever that bond between mother, father, and child. And then adoption, which is probably the best of them, and if you have some questions later in terms of the risk, we can talk about that. Okay. So why then does this recognition of same-sex marriage, in what respects does it pose ethical risks and challenges? Well, number one, it means that you are accepting as a societal norm that the bond between mother, father, and child is severable. What that is suggesting, the message you are sending, is that it is okay for adults not to take responsibility for their biological children. That they are expected to take responsibility only insofar as it is a matter of choice. And this is doubly reinforced in the context in which a child ends up going to a homosexual relationship because dad divorced mom. Now again, the message is these relationships are all severable. You know, the sex life of the adult comes first. Another ethical risk with this move to institutionalize same-sex marriage to children, insofar as becoming a parent becomes a matter of choice, and we have these technologies at our disposal for the creation rather than the begetting of children, it means that it's going to be hard to say, why can't I not choose the kind of qualities that I want? If I can choose to be a parent, why can't I choose somebody, a child with blue eyes and brown hair, and why not a boy while I'm at it? And that's where the logic of choice takes you. And insofar then, as choosing to become a parent results essentially in the commodification of children, that you get to choose the kind of child you're going to get. That also has very educative implications for that child. Because what does that child learn? That child learns that he or she has value insofar as she had certain characteristics that were regarded as valuable. That suggests that that child does not have intrinsic value. It suggests that that child has value only insofar as that child had characteristics that some adult wanting to be a parent decided were. And that is a tremendous threat to the idea of equality. Moreover, if you normalize the idea that we don't expect there to be a mother, father, child triumvirate, you are inviting greater state intrusions into the realm of the family. Why would this be? Well, quite frankly, we no longer know who belongs to whom and who is responsible for whom, because we have an institution now which is completely socially created, defined by the state, exists insofar as there's desire and choice, both of which can change. And so when there are disagreements among couples, it's going to be up to the state to decide who belongs to whom and what their respective obligations are. So these are some of the respects in which companionate marriage places children at risk. But this isn't all. But let's take a step back now and let's ask ourselves, there are serious, intelligent people who believe that same-sex marriage is necessary. Why do they believe that? It's important to think of their arguments and to consider the extent to which those arguments are persuasive. And I think at face value, many of them are persuasive, but if you think about it enough, you'll encounter some problems with them. Let's think about the kinds of arguments that I'm sure that you've all heard ad nauseum with the same-sex marriage debate that had gone on over the last 3 years or so. Number one, in terms of companionate marriage and its evolution, we can't turn back the clock. We already have children who are being raised by homosexuals. And what's done is done. We can't have these children hurt by in any way suggesting that the fact that they are in these unions means that their parents are lesser in any way. So because we can't change things, we have to accept what has happened. You know, the only fair thing that we can do is to recognize these unions. So that's the can't turn back the clock argument. Number two, the procreation is not essential to marriage argument. They point to infertile couples, heterosexual couples. Say, if you allow infertile heterosexual couples to marry, there's no difference between them and a homosexual couple. And so it is unfair not to allow them, and it shows that procreation is not essential to marriage because we already have infertile couples who can marry. Number three is the discrimination argument. It is that it being a foundational institution, how can we possibly discriminate against gays and lesbians by not allowing them to opt into an institution in which they may have all sorts of both tangible and intangible benefits? Number four is the what's the matter with two people loving one another argument. You know, they love each other, they're not harming anybody, which leads into number five, the no harm argument. I mean, to allow gays and lesbians to marry doesn't mean that heterosexuals can't marry. It's just making the institution more inclusive. Okay, I want to consider each one of these arguments. Let's take the can't turn back the clock argument. In part, they're right. It's true. It would be almost impossible now, even knowing that divorce is very detrimental to children, to turn back the clock. That is why it is a tragedy in both senses, because that didn't help children. That hurts them. The question is, are you going to take social tragedy and make it the status quo? And are you going to perpetuate and make that tragedy worse? Because with same-sex marriage, any time that that couple is going to acquire a child, society is sanctioning the severing of the mother-father-child bond. And to say that this is not hurting children, it will take a 30 years to get the hard evidence that children need a mother and a father. But most civilizations have known this. Okay, the argument about infertile couples. How can you possibly exclude homosexuals when you allow infertile couples to marry? Okay, well, there's a number of responses to this. Number one, the fact that infertile couples marry does not in any way rebuke the normative structure of child-centered marriage. Recall that marriage is normative, which means most of the time that happens, and that we expect that to happen. The fact that there are exceptions to it doesn't mean that you take the exceptions as what is normal. Also, with infertility, if there were a requirement that couples had to be fertile to marry, do you know who would be most hurt by that? Women. Because women spend most of their lives in a state of infertility. And so to recognize that infertile couples can marry, if anything, is something that empowers women within the institution of marriage, because she can't be traded in for someone younger when she gets older. Moreover, the idea that infertile couples can be married also has the auxiliary benefit that even if they cannot reproduce themselves, there's an expectation, because their sexual relationship is within marriage, that one or more of them who may be fertile is not reproducing with somebody outside of the union. So at least it has the effect of making sure that to the extent that there's procreation, even if it can't happen for you, the expectation is that it stays within the institution of marriage. Okay. Let's take the argument now that this is discriminatory, that it is just intrinsically discriminatory not to allow gays and lesbians to opt into the institution of marriage. Well, that works only if you accept that marriage is companionate. If marriage is simply the union of people for their mutual betterment, then of course it's discriminatory to exclude homosexuals from that union, because yeah, their lives could be made better as well. But if you accept that marriage must be child-centered in this normative sense, and if the best interest of the child is the standard, then there's nothing discriminatory about it. It's no more discriminatory than to say that you are discriminating against people with disabilities because you don't let them drive cars if they're blind. I mean, sometimes with a certain kind of societal function or purpose for which an institution exists, you know, that defines the eligibility for the institution. Okay, with the argument then that, you know, what's the matter with two people loving one another? And this is the kind of argument that I made to my grandmother when I was 15, when I myself favored things like same-sex marriage and thought I was so progressive. Grandma, what's the matter with two people who love one another just being together? Well, now that I am married and now that I have my own children, I can speak from experience that love is not enough. That we are mere mortals. That our emotions are variable. That sometimes we need the discipline of an institution that's going to make us stick through or at least try harder in the tough times, so that it's not just all about me.